Stop.
Welcome to the third episode of the Stop Button Podcast. This episode I'll be talking about The Vampire Bat, directed by Frank R. Strayer, The Mummy's Tomb, directed by Harold Young, The Matrix Reloaded, directed by the Wachowski brothers, and The Fountain, directed by Darren Aronofsky. It's hard not to be at least somewhat impressed with The Vampire Bat, if only because it came out in 1933 as a knockoff of the Universal Horror Pictures, except at this point there'd only been Frankenstein and Dracula and the Mummy. The film kind of brilliantly resembles a Universal Horror Picture in every way except the filmmaking. There's the Burgermeister in The Vampire Bat is played by the Burgermeister from Frankenstein. Dwight Fry plays a role somewhat similar to Renfield. It's only the three principals who don't really fit, and Lionel Atwell would go on to do a lot of Universal Horror Pictures, and the guy who wrote the script, Edward T. Lowe Jr., eventually wrote a Universal Horror Picture. It took him about 11 years, but he wrote House of Frankenstein. I mean, it's a knockoff, but what's kind of effective about it is it's a knockoff made on a much lower budget without music. And by 1935, Bride of Frankenstein was 1935, music was very important in the Universal Horror formula. So seeing one of these pictures without the music is very interesting. It's a transitory step. Is transitory a word? Transitory is a word. Cool. So it's like a transitory step. It's made by Majestic Pictures, who I'm pretty sure I'd never heard of before this one. The film was shot on the Universal set, but at night, presumably when Majestic could rent it for cheap. What's interesting about the set is that it's not directed like a Universal Horror Picture. Instead, a lot of crane shots. Frank R. Strayer had time to do lots of crane shots. His interior shots aren't that impressive. Way too much headroom. But the exteriors, the transition shots, it looks like Michael Curtiz shot this thing back in 33, 34, when he was doing lots of exterior movement. So that's really cool, and it kind of distracts you from realizing you've never seen the exterior of Lionel Atwell's house. It's referred to as the castle, but you never actually see it. Atwell is pretty bad. He would go on to develop a certain type of character, and he hasn't gotten to it yet here. Which is actually kind of odd, because the certain type of character he developed isn't the one that he's maybe thinking about Son of Frankenstein, when he plays the guy who Kenneth Mars plays in Young Frankenstein. That's actually not the standard Atwell performance. But anyway, so Fay Wray's in it. So this would have been just before King Kong. They really don't use her much. She's the girl in peril, but only a little bit. I mean, the movie only runs 65 minutes. She's second billed, and it's kind of like they couldn't get her to stay up late to shoot at night. The most interesting thing is Melvin Douglas, isn't it? Melvin Douglas being somebody who went on to greater fame. And he's fantastic in this, and I think it's one of the first... It can't be one of the first movies I've seen him in, but it could be. He's just great, and he's very aware of what film he's in, and he kind of almost mugs for the viewer when he has to deliver these crazy lines. Or actually, when the supporting cast delivers the crazy lines to him, you can kind of feel like he's understanding how absurd the viewer feels watching this. But then there's Maud Ebern, who plays Fay Wray's aunt. And it's never explained why Fay Wray works for Lionel Atwell or why her aunt lives there. I guess she lives there because she's a lab assistant. So none of that's explained. And it's never explained what kind of doctor Atwell is and why he needs a lab with all the bubbling things that Universal Labs have. Thinking about the vampire bat at all, it collapses. And it doesn't, which isn't to say it holds up much at all, it just is an interesting debacle in a lot of ways. It ends on a joke, and it's one of the most unfunny jokes you could end on. There's a whole comic element to it. Ebern's played for laughs, and it makes absolutely no sense why they would do this. For a 65-minute movie to be as meandering and as loosely constructed as this, it's impressive. Obviously, it was a cheapie, but you kind of feel like you're watching a first draft filmed. There are a lot of wipes as transition shots, which is interesting. It's distinctive, I guess. Unfortunately, the movie's in the public domain, so nobody's done a really nice restoration of it, from what I can tell. The version I saw, the contrast was off. And it's too bad, because I'm sure Strayer's shots just look fantastic. Those crane shots just look great on a nice print. It's an utterly forgettable film if it weren't for Fay Wray and Melvin Douglas. And also, it's this kind of, I don't know, bastard stepchild of a Universal Horror Picture Works. There's some term for what it is, you know, the transitory kind of picture that it is. And in that way, it's interesting, but maybe not for anybody who doesn't care about Universal Horror Pictures or how that sort of formula developed in the 1930s before becoming standard by 1940-41. The Mummy's Tomb is better than The Mummy's Hand, without a doubt. The direction is stronger from Harold Young. He's not quite scary, but he's at least going for scary, and going for scary sometimes makes a world of difference. It's kind of like an episode of Cheers, though, because it takes place in small town Massachusetts, and there's a mummy roaming the street. So you can kind of see the Cheers gang having headed out of town for some kind of a weekend where there's then the mummy terrorizing their weekend. Norm and Cliff would have a great time with it. It's a 60-minute movie, which is some of the reason I continued in watching the series. Just figuring that 60 minutes was doable, regardless of quality. But what I didn't account for is 10 minutes of it being from the previous film, being from The Mummy's Hand. They just edited it in. Maybe the most interesting thing about the film is that it takes 2 to 3 of the principals of the previous film, Dick Foran, Wallace Ford, and possibly George Zucco, and puts them in old age makeup 2 years after the last film to kill them off. It's almost an afterthought of a movie, which is kind of interesting. Leading man John Hubbard gets third billing and probably deserves about sixth. Elise Knox is a decent damsel in distress, but it's really Turin Bay, who barely has anything to do, who's the bad guy, who, he's the new high priest. He's at least amusing because, well, his character basically just replays the character in the first one, only in New England versus Egypt. And there's like this secret society of these high priests of Karnak who can get you a job as a graveyard caretaker anywhere in the world. Unfortunately, Lon Chaney Jr. is not much of a mummy. Apparently he didn't like the character, didn't like the makeup, and it shows. But the makeup also isn't as strong as the first films. I'm trying to think. Is George Zucco in it, or is George Zucco not in it? Well,
if he is in it, he's made to look like his predecessor in the previous film. Wait, if George Zuko is in it, he's made to look just the same as his mentor in the first film looked. And in this film, George Zuko would be playing the mentor to Turin Bay. But it's also possible Zuko just gets credited because they used enough footage of him from the previous film. Because they don't use a lot of footage of anyone else, and none of those people are even credited. It doesn't look like him. The build looks different. The guy looks completely different. I thought it was just a credit trick. I've been talking about the mummy's tomb for maybe 4.5 minutes, which is nearly a 20th of the entire film's runtime. What else could there be to say about it? If it's better than the previous one, and yet it's still really bad, it's kind of awful. There's a really cool crane shot at the end. Some of Young's direction's nice. Some of the edits are good. It's decently photographed. I mean, sure, they're shooting California for Massachusetts, but it kind of works. Wallace Ford is nowhere near as bad in this one as he was in the first one. There is Mary Gordon, though, as Dick Foran's sister, who is then leading man John Hubbard's aunt. Not to spoil too much, but when she gets murdered by the mummy, Hubbard doesn't even care. He's more concerned about the caretaker who's injured. I don't know if there's a cut scene or if they just brought everybody onto the set and shot what they wrote that morning. It's kind of interesting because it's not like there's no subplots. There's no acknowledgement. There could be subplots. And it makes me wonder who the Universal horror films at this point were intended for, because, well, you had Val Lewton starting up his at RKO around this time. I think Cat People's 42, and those were scary and made for adults. So who was Universal targeting then? It's teenagers, maybe? Obviously, probably teenagers and women, as Walt Disney said. So you get the teenage girls in the theater, the boys will show up. That isn't actually what Disney said. I think Disney said that you get the women in the theater and the men will show up, or it doesn't matter if the men show up. Kind of Purple Rose of Cairo sort of thing. So am I going to keep going with these wonderful mummy movies? I think so. I mean, they're only 60 minutes apiece, and I think the last one takes place in Louisiana, complete with accents. So that'll be a nice prep for my New Orleans trip.
I'm not sure where to start with The Matrix Reloaded. I had some ideas watching it of where one could start to talk about it, but none of them, well, I forgot one of them. And so I'm kind of left with some of the others, with some of the other ideas. The Matrix Reloaded it might be the most anticipated film sequel since Empire Strikes Back in terms of the audience's expectations and the sort of make or break of what the filmmakers could do. I think the only other film that could come near competing with The Matrix Reloaded in terms of that expectation would be Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. But even then, Raiders of the Lost Ark was kind of a cousin to Star Wars, so it's not exactly the same thing, but it is very close to Empire. And it seems as though the Wachowskis are somewhat aware of Empire. Unfortunately, it's also the most narcissistic sequel ever made. I'm not sure if the Wachowskis consider the entire film a waste of the audience's time, sort of a joke, because with the exception of some now boring special effects, the movie's filled with this philosophical mumbo-jumbo, and mumbo-jumbo's maybe a little harsh. I mean, it wouldn't be mumbo-jumbo if the last 6 minutes of the movie didn't invalidate everything that was said in those mumbo-jumbo parts. So with that invalidating last 6 minutes, what is left? It's such a twist revelation. If it weren't for the stupid cliffhanger ending, I think that I would have really appreciated it, because the entire movie is, I don't even know what the running time is. It's got to be 2.5 hours. It's a complete waste of time, and it's the work of people who could care less. And the whole concept of doing a two-part sequel to The Matrix, I mean, they couldn't bully a 4-hour sequel, a 3.5-hour, whatever. So they either bought into their own hype, or they decided to ride the success train as far as it would take them, giving up the chance to possibly make some good movies in between. What's interesting, it's like Empire Strikes Back meets The Matrix meets Tron, and then there's a big Die Hard reference, but all the Tron stuff, they introduce programs in The Matrix, not agents, not people, but programs, just like in Tron. And it's like they ran out, I don't know if they ran out of ideas or if they just never had any. Because the thing about the first Matrix movie is it doesn't have a sequel set up. You know how interesting it is to see romance scenes between Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss? It's kind of like watching, you know, paint dry. It might not even be that interesting. It might be watching dried paint. It might be like watching glass and waiting for it to slowly congeal over 20 or 30 years at the bottom. It's not that they have absolutely no chemistry. It's that, and here's where the Wachowskis sort of failed to understand, or maybe understood a little bit better than anyone who gave them money to make this movie. If you make Empire Strikes Back and people don't care about Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, C-3PO, R2-D2, Chewbacca, whoever else. I mean, hell, they even get you to care about Lando after he betrays everybody. I mean, that's great. There's no reason to care about Neo and all these other guys. I mean, there's absolutely none. It's got Harold Pierneau Jr. giving a bad performance. I love him, and he's just awful in this, because the script is just crappy when it comes to him. He's this useless throwaway character. And there's very little reason for him to have, you know, scenes to himself, because they really don't do anything with them. And then there's also Jada Pinkett Smith, who I think I've seen her in something else, and I sort of was aware that she was going to give one of the worst performances in film history, and she certainly does. She is incredibly bad. But then there's, trying to think here, there's something else. How dumb the protagonists are. They're learning all this stuff about the Matrix, about the programs, about werewolves and vampires and ghosts, and they don't question any of it. I mean, the thing is that once they get outside the Matrix, let's say, they would have to wonder, now, does the Matrix have like a static time frame, kind of like how it has the city? It just has a city. We don't know what city. In the first movie, it was Chicago. In this one, it's got, you know, a freeway out of L.A. So, don't they think about this? Didn't they give it any thought? And then there are the fight scenes, which are the most boring, cartoony, CG-looking video game fight scenes. They're not exciting. And I'm watching it, and all I could think of was Versus, and then Batman the first one, Batman Begins, and how in Batman Begins, when he fights the guys, you don't really see the fight scenes. It's kind of like Aliens or Predator or something. Some review I read said that. And how when you see the movie, that approach makes perfect sense. And then shortly after I saw Batman Begins, I watched Versus. And I totally disagreed. You know, it's like I learned something that, no, I mean, can you imagine a Batman movie made by Kitamura? It would have been amazing. And then you watch The Matrix Reloaded, and it kind of is, but it's boring and American and lame. And the whole Superman thing that they do a few times, I'm not sure if, you know, it comes back to the whole Keanu Reeves as the surfer Superman. They kind of give Neo a cape at times, and then he does the Christopher Reeve hand forward thing at one point. And the other problem is, we never really understand, is this hard for Neo? Because it's sort of implied in the first one that all they have to do to be able to do all the kung fu and the whatever, sky, whatever, is sort of free their minds to the point that they're aware they're in a simulation. And so, you know, there's the whole, like, they shoot at Neo and he makes the bullets stop and fall. But if he's this anomaly, shouldn't he be able to let the bullets just fly through him? Because his brain should know that it's not real or something. So that's a bit of a problem. It's a pickle. So is how Morpheus knows how to samurai fight or whatever. And they got as much mileage out of The Matrix as they could in the first one. And opening on a dream sequence really doesn't earn you much credit on a second one. But the film's not, it's not innovatively made. It's kind of the same stuff as the first one on a grander scale. And the Wachowskis are incredibly bored. They're filming video game cutscenes. You can feel it. There's none of that wonderful Panavision composition in this one that there was in the first one. The music is terrible. Same guy. I mean, the music is just awful. Don Davis again, but totally playing into the whole religious overtones, blah, blah, blah. And it's annoying and stupid and bad. I'm trying to think if there's anything to particularly recommend it. It almost turns around at the end when it says, haha, I made you watch this entire movie only to invalidate it. And it does it in sort of a self-congratulatory way. Not like, say, Ocean's 12. Not that much fun, but kind of a wink wink, like, if you're paying attention, you just realized you spent $7.98 or $9.50 for nothing, and you could have come and seen the next one. But then the cliffhanger, the cliffhanger's a bit of a screw you to the audience that is cheap versus being cruel. And at least a cruel F you to the audience is interesting. Watching this film, it's like the Wachowskis do not care if they ever get to make another movie, and maybe they don't. But there are a lot of movies that people make where they get to do whatever they want. Sometimes they do good stuff and sometimes they do bad stuff, but I don't think I've ever seen one quite like this where they get to do whatever they want, and so they do this bombastic sort of pseudo intellectual sequel, and they're totally bored with it. It's very obviously not what they want to be doing with their time, and yet they spent what, like, 3 years making it. I mean, there's these intricate, amazing, technically amazing fight scenes, but they're useless. And then it's like you're watching it and you're thinking about Kitamura off in the woods shooting it with, like, certainly not as many people as this one had. And the My last thing's going to be, why did they make the movie? I mean, didn't give any interviews about it, but didn't have any toys either. At least George Lucas could care less, but he's making a fortune off the toys, right? He's making a fortune off of licensing the toys. So he's got a motive. These guys, the Wachowskis, have no motive, artistic or commercial, for making this film. And yet they did, which kind of makes it an interesting footnote that The Matrix kind of launched the 21st century of film, and 4 years later, the Wachowskis were doing everything they could to kill it, but they couldn't, I guess, defeat the superhero steamroller. So my wife walked on this one during one of the fight scenes, so I don't think she's going to want to watch the third one, but now I'm actually interested. This one having a crappy cliffhanger and everything aside, the, I guess, two revelations at the end. One of them's interesting, and the other one was an amusing up yours to me, the paying audience member. And so, and also, after seeing how uselessly they use the virtual world of the Matrix in this one, you know, for action scenes. Like that courtyard fight that was really dynamic, or the fist fight in the dojo. Oh yeah, that was great. And then some office buildings or something. The real world at least has set design, right? So maybe the third one will be somewhat amusing. Kind of doubt it though. If you had told me that Darren Aronofsky would have made a great film with The Wrestler, I wouldn't have believed you. In fact, as it was in production, even being the Mickey Rourke fan I am, I couldn't believe that Aronofsky could pull it off. I thought that he would, well, you know, do Requiem for a Dream again. So if you were to tell me that I was going to react the way I did to The Fountain, which was Aronofsky's dream project, I wouldn't have believed you either, but at least with The Wrestler, it wasn't Aronofsky writing it, and all of my experience with his screenplays, Pi and Requiem for a Dream, are negative. In terms of how the film works, The Fountain is somewhat singular because it's a rather straightforward story masquerading as a, I don't know, sci-fi event picture that anyone was going to give Aronofsky $75 million to make this movie with Brad Pitt, who could not have handled the acting. Pitt's given some good performances, but the film's requirements for Hugh Jackman are he has to be three different people who are occasionally the same person, but don't know about the other people, but are aware of the other people. It's probably Jackman's best performance, just because since he's gotten to America, nobody's really asked him to do very much. The Fountain asks him to do a lot because it wouldn't make any sense if he didn't. And then there's the question of Aronofsky, who defined himself as this sort of an ultra-hipster director who could only compete with Christopher Nolan for pretentiousness. I mean, in different ways, but really, if you were to look at the year 2000, Christopher Nolan and Darren Aronofsky certainly made the two most pretentious films of the year, only at that point, Christopher Nolan seemed like he could pull off being full of shit and still make a decent narrative. Aronofsky couldn't, and so it's odd that it's turned around completely, that Nolan is pretentious to the point that he's utterly empty, and Aronofsky's made two films of shocking content, the kind of content that you don't see in American cinema
anymore.
Putting the wrestler and the fountain together, it's interesting because the wrestler, and I'll only talk about it for a second, the wrestler, when it reaches the end, could very easily have a failure ending, and so it has a glorious one, which is why the film works as well as it does. But the fountain rides this wave. No, that's not a good metaphor. The fountain's a buoy, and the tide rises and lowers throughout the runtime. And you get to the end, and Aronofsky, he ends it perfectly, which is certainly not something I would have expected from him. In fact, I sat and waited for the ending to fail, and it never does. A friend of mine, I think he really likes the movie, but he has problems with Aronofsky's direction, and I will have to disagree with him about that at some point. Aronofsky's direction in The Fountain is fantastic. It's better than his direction of The Wrestler because he's composing shots differently. He's composing them to, I think he said they were supposed to have some kind of timeless value, but really, he's incorporating special effects with the way the character experiences those special effects in a manner I really don't think anyone's done since 2001. Simply because what happens to Dave Bowman at the end of 2001 doesn't matter to anybody but Dave Bowman and the viewer. I can't think of any other sci-fi. And when I say sci-fi, I don't mean actual sci-fi story. I mean fantastic filmmaking, space filmmaking. I can't think of any other film that wastes such expensive special effects without filling the screen with other characters. Even something like Close Encounters of the Third Kind has many characters experiencing these events, and the reason you don't see the single experience of it often is because that's not how you write a blockbuster. And I mean, even a proto-blockbuster like Close Encounters Close Encounters was a blockbuster hit, which is kind of insane when you think about how smart it is and how stupid blockbusters today are. So I think the other film that comes closest would be Blade Runner, when Deckard's watching Roy Batty die. That's a scene that's for the character and the viewer, not for anyone else. But there aren't any special effects, which I think the only reason I thought of it was because of the sort of sci-fi filmmaking. And I really can't think of any other examples. I mean, I'm sure there are some in some dramas, but really, even when you think of sort of the best dramas about loss, the two that can make me cry at the drop of a hat, Terms of Endearment and Bridges of Madison County, neither of them give you that single person's reaction. It's always in a group. And that Aronofsky incorporates these special effects with it. These visuals is shocking and fantastic. And it's unfortunate that he apparently only has one of these in him. I'm sure he'll return to pretentious crap soon enough. Maybe he and Christopher Nolan can collaborate on something. I'm actually only being negative because The Fountain's so good that I don't want to get my expectations up for Aronofsky, because there's absolutely no sign that he will fulfill any of them or even come close. The Fountain is, like I said before, singular, especially when you think about the film starring an Australian and a English person. There's an AM way to call them. They don't have an AN. The English don't have an AN. A Briton in a film made by, I think, Aronofsky's from New York, with lots of Spanish influence. It's like a inverse of one of those international all-star pictures from the late 70s and early 80s, where you would have the British director shooting in Italy with the American, British, French cast. Somehow it's that reversed, you know, sort of if you could turn the celluloid into this permeable material and the eye move through it and sort of somehow look at it from the back. And it would have to be in, you know, it's like a photo negative, I guess. Alan Burstyn's good after being so terrible in Requiem for a Dream, and this sort of histrionic performance that, while critically acclaimed, belonged more on a Possession episode of Days of Our Lives, when Marlowe was possessed. Her name's Marla. Mark Margulies, who was in the other Aronofsky movies, he shows up in a small role. He's good. Aronofsky is able to use this sort of ultra-contemporary New York actor who's been an ultra-contemporary New York actor for 20 or 30 years, and instead he can turn him into a 15th century monk without any problems. Nice small role by Stephen McHattie. It's the kind of role that you would think they would have gotten Sean Connery for, just because it was so small. It's the difference, I guess, between The Fountain and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Cliff Curtis, Sean Patrick Thomas, Donna Murphy, Aronofsky cast the film really well. Technically, I'd never heard of the cinematographer before. Martin Bettebeek. He's fantastic. The music by Clint Mansell is great too. It's not actually like a technical marvel or anything like that, but it's technically masterful. I wonder, given that the film does have its fans, and Aronofsky, I guess, interacts with them, if I'm seeing something in it that he didn't intentionally put in it, because I think his fans are those diehard Pie and Requiem for a Dream fans who just carry over to it. I find it hard to believe Warner Brothers looked at this script, talked to Aronofsky about it, and bankrolled this picture. It's the most anti-commercial film I can think of being released by a major studio. And the idea it could have cost $40 million more and had huge sets and starred Brad Pitt is horrifying. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Stop Button Podcast. Please stop by the website at www.thestopbutton.com. Maybe leave an iTunes comment. There's also the Twitter feed at twitter.com/thestopbutton. Thanks for listening.